human beings, I'm speaking to myself, but human beings in general have zero clue how strong they are or what they have inside of them until they're put in a corner. If you're put in a corner by something, you're either going to get out of that corner or you're going to just die there.
My name is Matt Bros with Locked In, and I have been so fortunate in my life to be surrounded by some really awesome people. So I want to be able to get their stories out there so that we can all learn from them together. Welcome to the Excellence Culture. All right, I want to welcome everybody to the Excellence Culture. And this is season two, and which is really, really exciting. And I've been really excited about who we're getting to talk to today. He's a dear friend of mine, honestly, for a long time, more than two decades. But it's Josh Irving. And Josh is the founder of Socorro Tequila. And so we're going to have a good time today. we've got margaritas in front of us. We're being responsible.
Yeah, kind of.
But we're going to be talking about, you know, his story, what it's like to start a tequila company. And so let's just kind of go from there. Josh, I would love first for you to kind of introduce yourself just like right now from, you know, where you call home. Tell us a little bit about your wife and kids. Would love to just kind of go there.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. This is crazy to be on here with you.
Yeah.
It's like everyone says, you know, honored or pleasure. This is truly like a really cool honor to be on here. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
A little bit about me, you know, which I'm sure you'll find out, but I'm from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and now I live over in East Dallas and have the greatest wife in the world, Khaki. And I,
which is a very cool name.
Very cool name. Yeah, but don't spell it with an H. Drop the H. And so I have Khaki, which has been, you know, everything good that's happened in my life has practically come from her besides my parents. And then my son, Jack, who is four, and then my son, or my daughter, Teddy, who turned two on Saturday.
Yeah. And we already talked about the name Teddy. Teddy is an awesome name for a girl. Name.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. So for me, my my first memory of Josh is when he's 9 years old. Your dad was my young life leader in Mansfield, Texas. And I remember you 9 years old, you're just running around young life. Just in the coattails of your dad. And really, we've had a relationship ever since then. Like, because Josh was a golfer, and we're going to get into that. So for me, this is really, really cool to see all the success that you're having. It's not surprising because you've always had just this thing to you, and I don't even know, I have a word to it. So I would love for you to just kind of share a little bit kind of about your upbringing, the house that you grew up in, et cetera.
Yeah, it was a crazy life. You know, my dad did not have much of a father in his life, much of a father figure. And so he really played the role of best friend and father combination, which was the coolest thing ever growing up in that. We were all very heavily into sports, but he wanted to touch everyone. He was, you know, became a Christian, I believe it was, you know, during his college days, and really ran with that and never looked back. And as far as being an influence for us and kind of a best friend, and just, I would say, you know, I've never told him this, but a hero in a lot of ways, you know, especially with how he grew up. And then having my mom, who is kind of the foundation of the home, while us three boys ran around crazy playing sports and, you know, creating chaos. So had the upbringing of couldn't have been any better. Very social and very family oriented, homeschooled for a little while, and then just moved into school as far as going, you know, every day to private school, then to public school, and then back to private school. And so it was an amazing upbringing. But as you alluded to with Young Life, we were involved in church and Young Life and everything. And so I kind of got to claw and grind at all of those. And that's when, you know, Matt Brost became my hero. And and like, he's this all-American golfer and he's dating like this all-American soccer player. And I'm just like, this guy's kind of everything I want to be. Like, and he's got a great voice. I don't know if anybody
I've got a that. Good voice.
You've got a great voice.
Oh, singing.
Yeah, singing voice.
Yeah, I don't think anybody watching this has ever heard that voice.
Yeah, well, maybe you should sing.
But if you go to this place, karaoke night, Thursday nights. But, well, that's cool, man. I just remember your household being a place that was just so welcome. Honestly, any night of the week, we all knew as kids, you can go to the Irving house.
Yeah. It's an open door.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
And I want that for my house. And I might have some adjustments to make for that, but, okay. So I don't know if I ever had a drink at your house, but we're having a drink right now. We're having a margarita. And so I would love to hear from you. You, in my world, you're the tequila man. I mean, obviously not everybody gets to start a tequila company and a successful sure. tequila company. So, sure. I want to hear from you, like, really quick. Like, what goes in your opinion, what makes a really good margarita?
I think with a margarita, less is more. And so people can overcomplicate it a little bit. My favorite margarita is a Tommy's margarita or a skinny margarita with Socorro Reposado. It's really 2 ounces of Reposado. It's 1 ounce of agave nectar, and it's half an ounce. You can go 3/4 of fresh lime. Fresh lime is crucial.
Like squeezed lime?
Yes, like squeezed lime.
But not the bottles you get?
Yeah, like, you can get fresh lime juice in a bottle from like a Whole Foods or something like that, but okay. It's got to be like fresh or it's not going to taste right to me.
Okay.
And then if you want a little orange liqueur on the side, then put some orange liqueur and put a little in there, see if you like it. But mine is a Tommy's margarita with Reposado.
Okay. And Tommy's margarita is also considered a skinny margarita?
Yeah, skinny margarita, okay. Which is 3 ingredients, lime, okay. Agave, tequila.
Okay. Well, I had somebody make a little mix for us, and that's what we're having. It's not the exact mix that you're
talking really
about.
It's really good.
It's not that bad.
So
let's go ahead and cheers.
Yeah, and what was her name?
It was a guy, actually. Oh, his name's Julian.
Julian.
Yeah.
So cheers to Julian.
He'll probably be watching this. Yeah. So, one of the things that is a really significant thing that I think that has been in Josh's life is golf. We have that in common. I think a lot of people know golf has been a big part of my life. Golf has been a big part of your life. Josh played high school golf, a successful high school golfer. You went to SFA and played golf at SFA. And then you went on, actually, I would say your best golf was post-college. I want to just kind of hear from you a little bit, share your golf story a little bit, and maybe some of the impact that golf has made on your life.
Yeah, I really grew up playing everything, just as I think most do, and I was, I would say, a pretty good athlete growing up. And the thing that was so cool about where you and I grew up is that you could take golf carts whenever you were 13 to the golf course. And
I don't know if you were supposed to.
No, you weren't supposed to.
Yeah.
But I would.
Yeah.
So it was really after, it was going into middle school that I was like, everything else is not relevant. This is the game. No one determines the outcome like I can, you know, like I get to control my own deal. And I think that that's the addiction to golf for most people, is that like, either the addiction or the hate, you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, hey, that was me. That was on me.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't on anybody else. And so with golf, you know, playing in high school and really being pretty successful, I would say, and then going to college and really struggling. I think I got worse every year. So
right.
My freshman year, I was decent, and then a little worse my sophomore, a little worse my junior, a little worse my senior. And the craziest thing about that and reflecting on it is, it was the harder you try, the worse you got for me.
Yeah.
I just became obsessed.
You always had this natural swing, I would say that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just think if you take it for, I always say in golf, there's not an in-between you either have to be really not ignorant, but ignorant of how hard the sport is,
yeah,
and just see the hole and say, I'm going to hit it that way. Or you have to be really smart and analytical and be able to break the game and the golf swing down.
Yeah.
And if you live somewhere in between, I think you're in trouble, because like the game doesn't give back to you in that way.
Yeah.
There's two sides.
I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But that's very right. And I think I'm probably on the kind of careless side of it. Like just kind of what the game brings me, I've got to be content with. But
yeah,
the game of golf just teaches so many things. Like,
it's brutal.
Yeah.
I think that blessing and a curse for me is you're not going to really meet anybody who's more competitive.
Yeah.
The curse of that is that a lot of competitive people do not have an abundance of patience.
Yeah.
And so
I think I've known that of you. That, yeah.
And so, I mean, fast forward all the way to today, and, you know, I do a SWOT analysis on myself, and patience seems to fall on the weakness side.
Yeah.
Right? And I work on it constantly, but it's just not ever something that's going to come easy to me like being competitive is.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, imagine without having golf, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but for me, the game of golf has taught me, you know, to forget about those things that happened in the past, right?
Yeah.
The things that we don't have control over. Because in the game of golf, there is so much you don't have control over. You know, whether a ball lips in or lips out really feels like it's a challenge, whether you have control over that. And when that ball hits a cart path versus just the side of a green and it goes out of bounds, you know. So for me, I've felt like I don't know who I would be if I didn't play golf for the last 30 years. But I know since I've played golf for the last 30 years, I do have the ability to kind of forget about the things I don't have control over, but learn from the things that I do have control over. Right?
Yeah. That's the whole other side is,
yeah,
I can't and have a hard time forgetting about the things I don't have control over.
Yeah.
But I think the reflection, and that's how you get better at anything. If you just keep going and keep going and keep going and you don't reflect on what you could have done differently.
Yeah.
Any part of life, whether that's parenting or being a son or, you know, playing golf, like sit, reflect, look back and change what you could have changed and change it moving forward, or you're just gonna,
yeah,
you know, definition of insanity.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So let's kind of get into your career. I'd like to hear really post-college, where did this journey start with just kind of the spirits world and kind of what got you to the point of deciding to start your own thing?
Yeah. I don't think, as far as my career goes, I don't think you know how it started.
Okay.
Do you know?
Okay, maybe so, I thought I did.
But, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go.
So, graduated college. I refused to admit that I wasn't going to be good enough to play at the next level for way too long.
Okay.
And so, like, I was holding on to that for a long time. So, graduating college and being in a deep depression and realizing I wasn't any good at golf was tough. And so, I went to Dallas National and I started caddying.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that. Yeah. And so, I started caddying at Dallas National. And it was mostly for caddying, right?
Yeah.
And I was only doing it for a couple months, and I ended up getting on the bag of Mike Meese, who was President Bush's chief of staff at the time.
Okay.
Genius guy, the coolest guy. And I actually bag caddied for him. So we spent 5 hours that day, you know, walking, getting to know one another, like having fun. And I vividly remember, if Mike is watching this or I haven't been able to get a hold of him, and I would love to talk to him, taking him to his older Tahoe car and us shaking hands and giving a hug. And like literally within 2 weeks, I had an interview with probably every industry or was connected in probably every industry. Mm. And so he connected me to go play golf with Bennett Glazer and David Campisi. And you know where we played golf was what? It was the name of the club before it was Honor Club.
Columbian Country Club.
Columbian Country Club.
Yeah.
So I went.
Now it's Merido.
Yeah. And now it's Merido. And so I went and played golf as a 22-year-old or 23-year-old at Colombian Country Club with Bennett Glazer, who was the owner, and David Campisi. So I show up to Colombian, and I don't know, I'm just intimidated because I'm just looking for a job. And I show up, and Bennett's like, get your own golf cart. We're trying to play in less than 2.5 hours. And I'm like, great. Like, here we go. And then Bennett, I mean, we didn't speak a lot. He's an amazing guy, but he had me an interview in Houston and started working for his company at that time.
Okay, so is Bennett Campisi
connected? Bennett Glazer.
Bennett Glazer.
And then David Campisi.
David Campisi, okay.
Yeah.
So, and that's when you started, but I want to ask about Campisi. So, obviously, Campisi's.
Yes.
And that, Campisi started, he was probably maybe second generation?
Yeah, maybe? I didn't really get to know him a lot, honestly. I mean, he's an awesome guy.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a blast. I really talked to him probably 10 times more than Bennett. But Bennett
Glazer. That's the one that paved the way.
Yeah, Bennett was the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so Bennett gets me the deal in Houston, the job in Houston, and rumor has it still to this day.
And what job was that?
This was running really wine and spirits out in not a nice area of Houston. And rumor to this day is that, I don't know if it's true or not, that was Bennett's first route.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it was like 85 gas stations, like 3 CVS's, 2 Walmarts, and 1 Kroger, but like in not a nice area. And so I was selling Boone's Farm, a lot of it, and I was selling a lot of like Barefoot Moscato and then some bad tequilas and brandies, and just to places, you know, I'd go into a gas station, there'd be, you know, dead animals in the cold box and stuff, and I'm just trying to grind it out and get out of there. But you know,
did you stay connected to Bennett at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay,
a little bit. Yeah, it was a really cool kind of thing that I think he took a lot of pride in, and that we had met through caddying, and then introduced in a certain way, and then he kind of onboarded me through his company. And I feel as though he took a lot of pride in that, and he probably still does.
Yeah. Okay. So what was kind of the next step after that?
Well, I was calling my mentor at the time, who was in the industry that I had known forever, every day, and saying, will you please get me out of here? This is terrible.
Yeah.
I want to come work for you. Get me out of here. And so he would always mess with me and say, hey, how are your Boone's Farm numbers? And I'd be like, I don't know. I almost
so
shot
long was that today. How long was that season? The Boone's Farm season.
That was 8 months. That was the first 8 months of my career. I think I was making $32,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just selling Boone's Farm out. And it was crazy.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he finally made the concession to move me to Fort Worth to start selling liquor exclusively full-time to liquor stores and liquor chains.
Okay. Is this Brent?
This is Brent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mutual friend of ours. So
yes.
Brent Lewis is a stud. He's a great guy.
Brent Lewis is, he's one of my heroes in life and in work.
Yeah.
No doubt.
He's a really special guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and how long was the season of working at that capacity? And what was that role after the Boone's Farm role? What would you have called that role?
That was retail sales for liquor.
And what was the territory?
Territory was, I would say, Tarrant County.
Okay.
So, did that for a while. That was back in the day whenever we were making commission, and it was a great job, like an amazing sought after job back in that day. And I was the young punk, you know, taking a putter into the office at the end of, you know, our closing of the months and stuff, and trying to hustle the older guys. But it was really cool. It was much more of the family culture and inclusive and really probably my first moments of just loving the industry, because everyone knew everyone. No one was above anyone. And it was really just, we're all trying to hit a goal. Let's all do it together.
So related to that culture, because I love to talk about culture. So related to that culture, is there anything like any other kind of more specific description of that culture that you just loved out of that? Was it that there was a lack of competition, or were you all competitive with each other, but also helpful? Like, think about the kind of those dynamics as a culture.
I think what was so cool is that from a cultural standpoint, that job was people that have been in the role for 30 years. I was probably the youngest guy in the room by 15 years. The majority of people, I would say, had been there for 25 to 30 years. And what was so cool to me was I'm this insecure punk that thought he was going to play professional golf that's now selling booze for a living. And like, it was just such a...
Were you insecure, or are you thinking that in hindsight?
I'm thinking that in hindsight, and I don't know how I was at the time.
Because I mean, a lot of us that grew up playing golf, we walk into these things and we're like, yeah, let me tell you my story about golf. And we think we're kind of cool.
Yeah.
But,
I think I was insecure and didn't really know, you know, had always kind of planned out my life in my head.
Yeah.
And then whenever it went there, I felt like I'm just self-reflecting right this second. Yeah. But I felt like maybe there was a wreck and I was trying to figure out what was next and really needing some hands to pick me up or lift me up.
Yeah.
But it was cool the way that whole group of people, and I'm indebted to them forever.
Yeah.
In that room specifically, really kind of took me under their wing almost as like a little brother, and helped me stay loyal and committed to what I was doing, but really, you know, put their hand out whenever they didn't really need to.
Yeah. That's really neat. Okay. So let's keep going down the timeline.
Yeah. So I do that, and a company I loved a vodka back then that I was selling, and it was called Chopin vodka, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Potato vodka, number one potato vodka in the world. And I loved it, and I had wanted to work for them. And then something ended up transpiring where they were looking to fill a position. And so I started working with them, which was like my dream job of like, I can't believe I'm going to go work for Chopin. Like, I have so much passion and love for this brand. Like, this is going to be amazing. And it was awesome. And I learned a ton. And it was at the same time that Clase Azul Tequila and Chopin Mezcal were doing kind of like this temporary merger, I would say, to where Chopin was going to manage the distribution for Clase Azul.
Okay.
And so I got, I would say, very close with the owners of Clase Azul throughout this whole time period.
And for those people that don't know Clase Azul, you might know the fancy bottles that you'd want to put like a flower in or something. Like,
yeah.
The ceramic, blue, yeah.
Hand-painted bottles. Yeah. It's a beautiful package. Yeah. And I was able to watch through that. So it wasn't just, let me digress. So selling Chopin and selling Clase Azul, it wasn't just those two. Those two were just kind of the paving the way to give us the opportunity to sell other things. I was selling gins, and I was selling bitters, and I was selling every kind of whiskey from all over the world. And so with that, I was able to see all these owners making all these decisions. And I was like, well, that's smart, or that's really not smart.
Yeah.
Like, why would you do that? And you are able to see the dominoes just fall accordingly. But I got not only that learning experience, I saw a Polish company and a Mexico company, and I saw the different cultures, because those were the two that were leading the way. Those were the two that at every sales meeting, every personal interaction, you were able to look at those cultures and say, wow, that's crazy that how separated those are. And I just went and fell in love with these guys from the way that they were really living their life, the way that they were not saying it, even though they were actually taking the steps and moving forward with what they were saying.
Yeah.
And that was my, like, yes, I love tequila. I love the craftsmanship of it. I'm obsessed with, I'll argue with you all day if you want to fight about, I wouldn't fist fight, but I'll argue with you all day that besides mezcal, I mean, tequila is the most craft spirit when done right. It's crazy.
That's cool.
And so I loved all that, but the culture piece of like, man, these guys truly like love and appreciation and care. And like, it was just such a clean slate of just, this is what I want my life to be.
Yeah.
You know, I want to follow that. You know, those like wow moments.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah. I'm kind of, it's cool to reflect on all this.
Yeah, sure. No doubt. So you obviously decide to take a leap, massive leap of faith. What all went into really the decision to start your own thing?
I would say the decision's name is Pablo Antonori. So my business partner's name is Pablo. I met him through selling tequila.
Okay.
So I had left Southern Glazers and went and worked for Chopin Imports. He was working with Southern Glazers. And I met him, and I swear, Matt, I came home one day, and Khaki will be able to remember this. I came home one day and I go, if I'm ever going to do anything, it's going to be with that guy.
Yeah.
Because he's crazy and he's so smart and he's crazy and
yeah.
I like it. So
you got to have a little crazy, dude, probably.
You have to. I would never be sitting here with you. I mean, we'd be, you know, Texas Roadhouse having a beer and eating peanuts.
Which is fine.
Yeah, which is great. I'm not hating on Texas Roadhouse. They're great. But, you know, he really just pushed and pushed and pushed.
Yeah.
And I would push back at him and he would push back at me, but we built this relationship through tequila, through selling, through arguing, through loving. And then he would push at me, let's go to Jalisco. Let's go to Jalisco. And I would say, doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And
Jalisco's the place.
Jalisco's the place.
And yeah.
So he said, why are we doing this for other brands? We're building these other brands. We're creating these other brands. Like, you and I can go and we can create something special. But can we? Yes, we can. Let me show you. And so I give him a ton of credit, man. He pushed me outside of, I mean, what I didn't even know was uncomfortable, because I'd never thought that I would be able to break that barrier. And so he gets all the credit in the world for myself, and I don't give him enough, but it's okay. Cool to talk about.
And so Jalisco is the place where the agave farms are.
Yeah.
Right? And the distillery.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can make tequila in 5 states in Mexico.
Okay.
Jalisco, I don't know the exact number at this point, but I'm going to say it's around 90% of all of tequila in that one state.
Okay.
And so that's where we went and started going and started knocking down doors and talking to anybody that would talk to us.
Okay. And so you're starting this new brand, basically. You and Pablo, had you defined at this point, like, what your role is, what his role is?
No.
Or are y'all just kind of locking arms saying we're doing this together?
No. We zero defining, maybe not even to this day, actually. But we saw an opportunity and a gap in the market to really go and see how much we could fulfill that gap.
Yeah.
And we're still doing it to this day. But the coolest thing is, man, if you look, you know, we collectively put, I think, whatever we had, $42,000 to get leadway to investors, right? To be able to have those conversations. And if you look at our first deck, which is the sloppiest thing ever, our culture, our beliefs, and what our strategy was has not changed one bit.
Wow.
Crazy to think about. And it's really, really cool. I was looking like back in the fall and I was like, wow.
But it's been a pretty, I mean, it probably feels like it's a long time ago, but in reality, as successful as you all are, it's been a pretty quick ride.
Super quick.
Yeah. So, okay, first I want to ask, as you're going into this, I want to ask you who's been probably the most influential people, or just a single person that you want to talk about. Like if I was to ask you, who's an influential person in your life that's led you to, you know, this journey that you've been on with Socorro?
Yeah, as far as this journey goes, I would say that it's Pablo.
Yeah,
I think that nothing exists without his push and his belief and his will and his genius, really.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah, he gets a ton of credit, and I'm blessed by him pushing me, but I'm blessed that he's in my life. He's an amazing human that I'll go to battle with and war with or war for anytime called upon.
Yeah. That's awesome. Okay, so I'm looking at this this logo on your shirt. So I want to hear about, because there's a lot going on in this logo. So explain to me kind of, I haven't asked you this yet, but tell me about this logo.
We started going to Jalisco, mm-hmm. and I was watching, you know, Netflix shows that like will scare you away from Jalisco, right? Mm-hmm. And I've been there multiple times, multiple distilleries. I've been different states in Mexico to visit multiple distilleries, but you haven't been to rural Mexico mm-hmm. like this. This is, you know, curtains pulled back. Let's, you know, dig into what's really out there.
Yeah.
And it was really scary.
Yeah.
It was scary for me. It was scary for my wife. It was just a really scary time because of the unknowns. And Pablo will sit in here and tell you, you know, I have 9 lives, Papa. Like, we're going to be fine. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's good to know. But whenever we started going, I was already scared and timid and you know, had a lot of pushback against it. And then whenever we started interacting, which I can understand Spanish decent, I can speak it enough, but Pablo would start having conversations, and then before you know it, it's like this was our second trip and we're driving out into the middle of nowhere to go to this person's house that wants to host us for dinner and wants us to sleep at their house. And I'm like, this is insane. This makes zero sense. I was like, we literally just met them. I'm this gringo in the middle of Mexico.
Yeah.
And I vividly remember calling Khaki and I'm saying, if you do not hear from me tomorrow by this time, I have the worst feeling. And I am arms like locked with Pablo the whole time we're there. And this was the first trip. Or the first like invite to a house.
Yeah.
And we go there and I'm like, this does not feel right. Something is off. This makes no sense. Why would these people do this? I made him sleep in the bed with me. No lie. And like something against the door. And because I knew something bad was going to happen. Well, didn't really sleep, but get up the next day. Nothing has happened. Breakfast is ready. Right. And then you leave. And you're like, oh, that was weird. Why did they do that? Why did they do that for strangers, people they don't know? And I still couldn't process it. And then we kept going back and it happened again. And then it happened again. And I went from this fear of death, like literal fear of death, thinking I'm dying, no joke, to like, this is the coolest thing in the world. It went from death to inspiration, like massive, like it literally to have the chills, like massive inspiration.
Yeah.
And I'm big. If you talk to anybody who works with me or really anybody I know, I'm big on if you ignore inspiration, you're a fool and I don't want to be around you.
Yeah.
And so before we even had a distillery, before we had a tequila, we knew we wanted to do something. We ran into some terribly sad poverty stricken situations. A lot of it was with kids. And majority of that was with water and accessibility to potable drinking water. And so I've said this before, but I'll say it again, in that I know if we didn't create a tequila, I would be doing something, Pablo would be doing something to help alleviate the people that inspired us. Mm-hmm. Right? Living out our dream of making tequila, inspired by the people, by the culture, see a problem. If you don't do something, who are you?
Yeah.
You know, like what kind of person?
Mm.
And so Socorro, it translates to help or assistance. And then if you see the logo, it's water helping hands agave. And then on top, it says case for a case or caja por caja. And so our initiative is that every case of tequila we sell, we donate a case of water to different orphanages, nursing homes. And we actually now supply clean drinking water for two entire towns.
Mm.
So,
wow, bro.
Yeah, it's been, it's powerful, man.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, man.
Yeah.
I'm glad I asked.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
But
I mean, it's something that.
Yeah, that is so good.
There's probably, you know, 30,000 people in the state of Texas that have a bottle of Socorro in their house. And there's probably, you know, 1,500 that know that.
Yeah.
It's something I'm proud of, and it's the coolest thing we get to do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the act of charity that you guys are doing is special. It's all special. And the story that led to it's really special too. So I really appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah. I'll tell you something real quick.
Yeah.
Pablo has never done any drugs before. He loves to drink and he loves to eat, but never drugs, never cigarettes. The very first, true story, the very first orphanage we go to, and this was like in April of 2020, whenever it was like orphanages, even like you could deliver water, but like they weren't going to let you in, some of them, you know, because of the COVID and everything. And we were walking out both bawling, crying, like arms over shoulders. And I remember the exact street we're on, and it's in Tepa in Los Altos. And he goes, Papa, I know what people say about like drugs or like ecstasy. He's like, there's no way anybody could ever feel better than I feel right now.
Mm.
He said those exact words. And I was like, cool. It's like, that's the coolest thing ever. I'm always looking back on that.
That's really cool, man. That's really cool. So when would you say like you guys were, what year was it that you guys were ready to sell bottles of Socorro?
2020.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was telling you, I
can't imagine that was easy.
No, I had a big moral confliction with my other job. And so made a mistake, you know, and had my son Jack in September of 2019. Quit my job September 2019. My mistake was I quit on my birthday, which was the 28th, and didn't realize that your insurance drops or that the 2 weeks, and I didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so had a son, quit my job September 2019. And then we were ready to roll at the beginning of 2020. And then all of that transpired.
Mm.
It was. Yeah. Tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, spirits was obviously accelerated, enhanced kind of during COVID, but I can't imagine a very brand new company.
No.
You know, and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spirits as a whole exploded.
Yeah.
But spirits exploded because you were getting people that were going to the liquor stores that were never going to go in there. And they were all grabbing what they had seen on TV.
What they already knew.
Yeah. They weren't there to.
But becoming known. Yeah.
Yeah. They weren't there to trial anything. And so our business plan was completely ripped to shreds. And we lived in mom and pop liquor stores. I mean, we lived in there. Tastings every day, talking to anyone we could. That Pablo always says, it's like we were like drug dealers, man. He was like, remember like we would get people to like take off their masks so we could like give them a little shot of tequila real quick, like on the side or something. Because we were just hustling and bustling however we could to just put our brand like forward facing.
Yeah.
And then we would try to help restaurants, you know, alleviate their pain and talk with them and try to help in any way we could, whether that was, you know, service or just being a shoulder to cry on. Mm-hmm. As long as I always said, you know, as long as we can cry on your shoulder back.
Okay.
But it was brutal.
Yeah.
What was cool about it, because Pablo and I have spent a lot of time reflecting on that and like how hard it was. What was cool is that it truly showed me that human beings, I'm speaking to myself, but human beings in general have zero clue how strong they are or what they have inside of them until they're put in a corner. And I probably couldn't before that have taken on a cat. And like after that, I feel like I could take down a lion.
Yeah.
You know, like it was just like, if you're put in a corner by something, you're either going to get out of that corner or you're going to just die there.
Yeah.
So,
so growing a family.
Yeah.
Starting a tequila company in the midst of COVID when nobody knows who you are and trying to put food on your table.
Yeah.
Hard. And yeah. And not just you, but you've got a partner too.
Yeah.
That you could feel equally responsible.
Yeah.
That lends, you know, we might digress just a little bit. Because I want to get into kind of tasting some of your awesome tequilas too. But I do want to ask, and my wife wanted me to ask this, just because it seems like it's a theme right now. Just the balance of everything that you've done and balancing it with the role of husband and father, you know, and the challenges to that, but any kind of learning that you can share, you know, related to that?
Yeah, I think that as far as balancing the role of a husband and a father, I think that I fall short, you know. I think that if I'm doing a self-reflection, which I kind of am,
yeah,
you know, right this moment,
yeah,
I think that I fall short on that. And I do not have a formula, and yeah, I don't have, you know, I wish I did.
Yeah.
And I don't have, it's not an ideal thing for me to be able to say, but I appreciate the question. And like, it's something that I need to do a better job. And I am working on trying to formulate how that's going to look. You know, luckily, like I said, Khaki is the greatest wife in the world, and I truly believe that. And so, she's been there to support me through this whole entire process, and she's been there to continue to support me. And that's been cool, but not a fun thing to swallow. Just have not been up to what I view, you know, is the right, right way to go about it.
Well, I mean, your dad is, you know, you've got an example that allows you to reflect even
totally
more, you know. And I would say, like, there is a reality to, like, industry these days that it's so fast-paced and so intense.
Yeah.
And it feels like if you're not improving, you're digressing. And so it's just really good to reflect, man. So thanks for being honest there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so I want to kind of break a little bit, and I want to hear about your tequilas, okay? Because if you don't know about Socorro, it's funny because I've been planning on having you on this podcast for a while now. But ever since, like, we met a few months ago, I'll talk to people and say, yeah, Josh Irving's going to be on the podcast. And I'll say, it's Socorro. And they're all just like, yeah, I love Socorro. Yeah. And so for me, like, I think you guys have hit a price point that's really unique. And in the quality of your tequila is well beyond the price.
Crazy.
You know? And so I want to hear, like, as I'll go ahead and pour some, but what do you think we should have a taste of.
I mean,
we've been having a margarita. This has got reposado in it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to start with Blanco.
Okay.
You have to. If you ask any, like, people are always like, hey, what's your favorite? And I'm like, Blanco. It's my baby.
Yeah.
You know? Thank you.
All right.
I mean, Blanco is the... If the Blanco is not good, nothing's going to be.
Okay. So tell people a little bit, because you shared with me, like, everything starts with Blanco,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. So tell me that a little bit. Like, we don't have to get in from probably totally agave plant to...
Yeah.
But Blanco is the beginning. No aging, right?
No,
like,
aging.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's the purest tequila. I mean, as far as like purists go, or purists, like nothing touches it. You know, this is agave plant, which is, I've told you, it looks like a blue ocean. If you're driving in Jalisco, I mean, it's gorgeous and it's all hand done and it's perfectly cooked. And it's an amazing tasting plant that you then, you know, extract the sugars from to create alcohol, and then you distill, and this is what Blanco tequila comes out with just water. So it's agave, and then it goes through the fermentation, and then it's water. So it's really agave and water that's alcohol.
It's really interesting, because when you explain that to me first, you know, you think the purest is the most expensive, right? But there's a lot that happens in these other tequilas, and it doesn't necessarily devalue these other tequilas, but...
Right.
It was cool to me to hear that, like, Blanco is the purest, but it happens to be the most affordable. It's on the shelf at the same time.
Yeah.
So
it is weird to think of it that way. I've never actually thought of it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I would pay the most for Blancos, but I don't like anything touching mine, generally speaking, but besides a margarita.
So let's try this.
Yeah.
Is there anything that I should be thinking about?
What would have been cool if, you know, Pablo will smuggle in some cooked agave every once in a while. And so what would have been cool if I would have brought some of that, so you could kind of taste the cooked agave next to the tequila. But, I mean, that's our whole
goal. It's just the plant. I mean, you're tasting
that's our whole
the plant.
Goal is we're trying to get cooked agave and we're trying to massage the whole process to make sure that that's what's coming out into the glass.
Okay. So. Wow.
And
yeah,
you know, Pablo does an amazing job of really yielding everyone's palate. Every time I taste something, like, I obviously know every batch of Socorro by heart, but I like everybody to express what they taste, express what they smell, because, like, it's the only way you're going to know, you know?
Yeah.
Give me something, bros.
I don't know, because I've...
Come on, bros.
I know. So I've had tequila straight with, like, whether that's extra añejo or añejo, but I've never just done Blanco straight, but this is a lot smoother than I expected.
Yeah.
It's
awesome.
And so, I mean, I taste tequila, but I just taste a very smooth, rich, you know, tequila taste. So.
I mean, one thing we do that not a lot of companies do, a differentiator for sure for us is, and sometimes we do it a lot and sometimes we do it a little. I mean, we have, not to get too technical, but if you think of a wine glass and the shape of a wine glass, why is it shaped that way? And it's to aerate the wine, right?
Yeah.
All alcohol works the same, and that it's going to break down to open up. Right?
Okay.
The more that it aerates or oxygenates. And that's a process that we do because the core of the spirit is so good,
right? Yeah.
Because you're trying to, again, get back to that cooked agave. Now, if you do that with a bad tequila, it's probably going to get significantly worse, right?
Yeah.
But if you really, I encourage everyone, I mean, I know, you know.
I probably poured you too much.
Sorry. No, this is great, but you'll drink whiskey. So do it, you know, have a sip. Spin it around, come back a few hours later and try it, and it will be completely different.
Like, wow.
Soft and velvety, and, like, the aromas will really open up. So it's fun.
Well, I wish I didn't have my first sip like a shot. So I had the whole thing.
It was pretty, it was aggressive, but inspiring. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Maybe.
Kind of went back to college days a little bit there. But, okay. So we're going to go down, the road a little bit. So I'm going to do smaller.
So
where should we go
smaller?
Well, we don't have six glasses.
So Reposado is rested, and we had that in the margarita. That's what Reposado translates to, is rested. Añejo is old.
Okay.
This is plus or minus 4 months in virgin American oak. This is plus or minus 14 months in virgin American oak.
Okay. So and this is plus or minus zero, basically.
This is zero. A Blanco can be up to 60 days.
Okay.
I would go the Añejo just because it's really cool, and I know that you're a bourbon guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really cool in that I think any good Añejo, it is a fight between the agave and that shining, or the oak and the barrel shining. And like, your palate should fight. And that was our whole goal with the Añejo, was to put them up against each other and let everyone's palate decide.
Okay. So in the stores, for people that go into the stores, are most of your, because I know at the store that I go to, they carry everything, but are most places carrying all your bottles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're in like just less than 1,000 liquor stores, and most have all.
Okay. I can't believe I'm talking to Josh Irving, who's got something that's in 1,000 stores.
Yeah. I can't either, honestly.
Yeah. That's bonkers. And I would ask you, so we'll get into what this tastes like a little bit, but I mean, what do you kind of credit? Like, what do you credit to just the success you guys have had? There's obviously a significant quality of your product and a good price point, but was there just some favor that just kind of happened from some source that, or like, was it hustle? Just, you know?
Yeah.
Because I feel like I ran into you about a year and a half ago, or maybe 2 years ago, and you were coming out of a restaurant. And you had bottles in your hand. So it was very obvious that you, the founder of this tequila company, had gone to this restaurant trying to get them to serve your tequila.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
Can't really tell someone how to do something if you haven't done it yourself.
Yeah.
You know? I think that in anything, I follow really this wide rule. And it's have a great product. Be a great person, do what you say you're going to do, and show up when others need you.
Mm-hmm.
That is really the everything for me, along with lion mentality.
Yeah.
I haven't said this in a really long time, but you have these companies that have hundreds and thousands of employees, and there's, you know, our little team, but like that company that has thousands of employees doesn't want to go to war against us because we'll break them down.
Yeah,
we're savages, man. We have a different mentality, and it's a refuse to lose it with intention and truly, truly care about what you're doing, but be intentional and be real. But you wake up every day excited, and you wake up every day with a mentality. I mean, it's, you know, lion mentality. It's a mentality. There's no reason they should be the king of the jungle besides they think they should be the king of the jungle.
Yeah.
You know, like it's the, let's just wake up and let's go do it.
Yeah.
And that's the formula.
There's
nothing besides that. We don't have any secret sauce. There wasn't some blessing that was poured over us. It's go be a hustler, go be a grinder, go be a good person, and show an advantage to whoever you're selling it to.
Yeah.
But.
Okay, good. And I heard you say earlier you've got about 13 employees right now.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, there's 13 of us total.
Okay. Let's go ahead and try this. So this is the Añejo. Have you guys ever done an extra Añejo?
Not on Socorro.
Okay.
Not on Socorro.
So how much time does an extra Añejo like have?
Over 36 months.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to get my framework right. So, and then this is 14, you said.
Yeah, this is, I mean, honestly, it's just seasonality. Whenever it's ready, it's ready. Yeah. On the aged spirits, Pablo will tell you so it doesn't get overcomplicated, but like sometimes it's just over 12 months and sometimes it's 18 months.
Okay.
It's whenever it's ready.
Okay. Yeah, there's a big difference. And it's really just the oak. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Like you're not adding any kind of spices or anything like that.
It's just the oak.
And is the oak already like flavored or?
It's virgin oak.
It's
virgin American oak out of Guadalajara, actually.
Okay.
Which is weird to think about in and of itself. But yeah, it's virgin American oak. It's lightly toasted. I mean, there's obviously sugars in the wood. But other than that, no, it's just, that's the flavor that comes out.
That's very good.
It's crazy good.
It's very good.
What do you get, agave or oak?
I certainly get more, I'm just not, I guess I don't have a very mature palate. I get,
come on.
I get, like, it's so good, but I get more of whatever is not, because obviously if this is pure agave.
Yeah.
This is like the purest form of agave is the Blanco. So I'm getting more of whatever else is involved. So it's got to be the oak.
Yeah.
Like, but I still taste the agave. It's like this, it's a good blend. Yeah.
Yeah. On the front of my tongue, I always get like the oak and the spice and like the, like a toasted like almond or something like that. And then on the back is when the agave will kind of roll.
Yeah.
For me.
I feel like it's, you know, Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich I'm taking. No. No, this is really good, man. This is really good.
It's been fun, man.
Yeah.
It's been really fun.
Okay, so we're going to start winding things down a little bit, but I would like to hear a little bit from you, like, how do you kind of define success for Socorro? You know, and it, I'm going to frame it up in a unique way, because I don't really want like a textbook answer. So when you go to bed at night and you put your head on your pillow and you feel kind of positive about your day and the direction that things are going versus nights when you put your head on your pillow and it's just like, it's a grind and I'm struggling, you know, like, what do you credit to those days or maybe weeks or months when you feel like you guys are going in the right direction?
It's an amazing question, by the way, like professional, like all time question. I would say that if I was going to pinpoint one thing as far as laying on the pillow, it would be employee development.
Yep.
And I don't even say employees, I hate titles. And so that was probably not the right,
you're good.
Not the right thing. But whenever I am at my happiest, it's whenever I can see that someone is taking a new step in their career to better themselves, and whether I've had an influence on that or not, I celebrate it a lot.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much the coolest thing in the world to see. Whenever you're trying to row this boat and like someone's grabbing a bigger row and rowing faster, you know?
Yeah.
It's just inspiring.
That's a really good answer, man. And I think any entrepreneur that kind of gets to the point where, because I know you're not to this point, you're still in the trenches, right? Of growing this brand. I work for a company that has a guy that started Lockton, right? His name is Jack Lockton. And the opportunity that he's paved, and I would assume that he got a lot of his just satisfaction. That might be the word, right? Like that feeling when you put your it's a satisfaction, right? Like
that's probably it.
And so he probably got his satisfaction from just seeing, you know, just the success of others that he's paved the way for.
Yeah,
you know, so I feel like that's a little bit what you're saying, right? And when you have an employee that's one, whatever their job is, but they're just kind of winning at their job.
Yeah.
And that's probably got to be really, create a lot of satisfaction.
It's yeah. the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. So I would encourage you that you're probably doing the right thing then. If yeah. that's what you're going to bed at night thinking about, yeah. that's an awesome thing.
Yeah.
Because that's not everybody.
It's a different, satisfaction's definitely the word.
Yeah.
And like, it's almost like high. You yeah. said your highs.
Yeah.
It's an indescribable high.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Like this is inspiring. It's inspiring. Yeah. It's satisfaction. It's high. It's, yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. Okay. So what do the next 5-10 years kind of look like? And I'm going to ask for Josh Irving, because I don't know if it's, you know, only Socorro, if there's something else, but love to kind of hear what's on your mind thinking about the future.
Man, I think that anybody who doesn't know, Brost has been an entrepreneur since he was young. I mean, talking about everything. I think you've always inspired me with, hey, what do you think about this? You know, whenever we used to do the golf deal together with, yeah. I thought that was always so cool. But being an entrepreneur at my soul now, because you're never there. You can think that you're one, but you're never there until you've really gone into the trenches, like you were saying. It's like, I feel like some people have a hard time, and I've heard this a lot, that people have a hard time focusing on one thing because the mm-hmm. brain wants to go everywhere, right? I know how special what we have
yeah.
going is. Like, I did not take it for granted at all. And so it would be such a disservice to take my eyes, brain, attention, anything off of this to put it anywhere else right now. And so I had a mentor ask me he told me it was like his fifth time the other day. Hey, what are you know, the next, in 5 years, what's Socorro? And I'm like, one day at a time, man.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. if I put my best foot forward every day, like great things are going to happen.
Yeah.
And if I'm thinking out into 5 years, I want to do this, or 5 years, I want it to have this much money, that I'm going to make unwise decisions yeah. in the present.
Yeah.
So he said, good, I'm going to stop asking you that because you've answered it the same way every
yeah.
time.
He's improving every day.
Yeah, just every day there's a moment of reflection moments of reflection, and then there's moments of let's just go, and this is the best move because it's the best move.
Yeah.
And it's a never-ending game, but I think that's the fun and that's the addiction of it.
Yeah. Well, this has been really cool, man. I really appreciate it. Any kind of final words at all, or?
No, I think it's, I started this off, I'm humbled, you know, yeah. super humbled. I think it's amazing what you're doing. And I don't know, you've always been a hero and in my eyes, you know? And yeah. so it's really cool to be sitting here and drinking tequila that, I mean, sounds cocky, but that I've made.
Yeah, I just remember that 9-year-old kid, man.
Yeah, and, running around.
So it's so cool. So
I appreciate it, yeah. Brost, and I, you know, it's been, you said earlier, 27 years, and so no, did you say 27?
Yeah, 27.
27 yeah. years, and so and 27 more.
Yeah,
you know.
And I would also, yeah, for sure. And I would also want to make sure that we give a good shout out to Eddie Irving I've lost touch with him for the last couple of years, but I look forward to seeing him, man.
Yeah. He's the coolest dad. I mean, my mom and dad were awesome.
Yeah.
I hope they don't offensively, but they're better grandparents. They're awesome.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the excellence culture.
Thank you.
And, I wish you the best, man.
And salute.
Yep.
Thank you.
Cool.
Cheers.
Yep. Thanks, man.